Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along, folks, to our last function here at Governor Phillip Tower. We're back into Phillip Street next week, so thanks for coming along. And it's great to have the Honourable Alex Hawke back, I think for the second occasion addressing the Sydney Institute. He's well known to all of you, so I'll be very brief. He worked in business and then he became a ministerial advisor, and of course since 2007 the member for Mitchell. Mr. Hawke held ministerial posts in the Turnbull and Morrison governments, and I should also say that Mr. Hawke is an officer in the reserve of the Australian Army. So tonight the Minister's going to speak for us on the topic of Australia and the Pacific. Their prosperity is our prosperity. Mr. Hawke, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jared, for that introduction. And look, I think given where we are today, I ought to say in the beginning, coming from the federal government inside the defence portfolio with Minister Reynolds, we all have our thoughts at the moment with the people of New South Wales and Queensland who are captured in these terrible fires. From the federal government's perspective, we've put our defence forces on standby, and Minister Reynolds, our defence minister today in the Senate, told the Parliament and Australians that we're also looking at how to use our new powers in relation to the Defence Force reserves to make sure that all possible options are being considered to call up any needed resources from the federal government's perspective. So we really appreciate all of the work that is being done by our firefighters, by our first responders, by the communities who are working together out there. And it would be remiss, I think, of us not to start today by just acknowledging the terrible circumstances that we find ourselves in. And we send all our thoughts and prayers. I think we'll be sending a lot more effort from all around the country to these communities and to the people affected in coming days. But you can rely on the government at the federal level and state level to work very closely together to do everything we can. And while we're hearing a lot about catastrophes in our Sydney basin, we're hearing about the catastrophic ratings that have been put out, and some people are thinking, gosh, why are we doing this? Well, I think the fire commissioner here in New South Wales, Shane Fitzsimmons, put it best when he said, we need to be over-prepared to protect life, and we need to be prepared to save life and prevent disaster. And I think the preparations that they've been making in that regard are absolutely outstanding. So we thank all of them for the work that they're doing. So tonight, of course, Jared, I'm here to speak on the portfolio that I represent, the Pacific Step Up, and the work that we've been doing in the federal government's level. I'm sad to hear this will be the last time that you're going to be here in this building, and honoured in a sense to be the last person to give a presentation from this pulpit, having been here once before. And if I had have known, I would have brought many more boxes, because you've got some fantastic books in your office, Jared, and I would have stolen hundreds of them off you. You really have some collector's items in there. So I might ask my staff who are here to go in there while we're here and help Jared move. Look, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for the opportunity. The Sydney Institute obviously is a great institution, and tonight I'd like to speak a little bit about what we're doing in the Pacific and Australia's role in the world. I think you can obviously see that in the recent times we've had a government and a Prime Minister committed to the Pacific, and in particular to our Pacific Step Up. 12 months ago, Prime Minister Scott Morrison visited Townsville, that great garrison town in Australia. And in front of the men and women of the Australian Defence Force, he said, "My government, the government that I have the privilege of leading, is returning the Pacific to where it should be, the front and centre of Australia's strategic outlook, our foreign policy, our personal connections, including at the highest levels of government." And our justification for doing this, founded in the foreign policy white paper commissioned by the Turnbull government, is simple. And again, in the words of the Prime Minister, this is our patch, this is our part of the world, this is where we have special responsibilities. We always have, we always will. We have their back and they have ours. We are more than partners by choice. We're connected as members of a Pacific family. So they are the what and the why of what we are doing and what the government is doing. So my address tonight will unpack, I think, some of these how questions. How are we doing this? How is Australia seeking to pursue our Pacific Step Up and the shared benefits to Australia and our Pacific family? The government's Pacific Step Up is, of course, about building strong partnerships for the prosperity and the stability of our region, not simply because it's the right thing to do or not simply out of our own self-interest, but rather because we want to work in partnership with those who call the vast blue Pacific our home. We want to strengthen their security, their stability, their resilience, and ensure that all the people in the region have what they desire. The past 12 months have been very busy. And certainly, if you look at the amount of visits that we've had over 50 visits at the senior level by governmental officials and ministers, 50 just in a calendar year. And myself, I've visited 9 countries in the last 4 months. The Prime Minister has set this bar very high, and he's outlined in our travel priorities as a government that the Pacific region comes first in the travel priorities of cabinet ministers and the government, and certainly travel to the Pacific ought to be prioritised throughout the year, which makes a big difference. The visits, of course, build upon the unique relationship that we have, and we've had so many visits to Fiji, of course. I think this year when we visited Frank Bainimarama, Prime Minister Bainimarama in Fiji, maybe for our second or third time, I have to say we ran out of issues to talk about, which is the first time I've been in an international diplomatic event where we said, let's wind up our meeting and go to the football. And I think that goes to show the contact is regular, it's constant, the issues we're working through are progressing, and the relationship is deep and strong. And when you think about where we've been with Fiji in recent times, it's great to see that the Fiji relationship is back on track where it should be, in a great and healthy state between two leaders, two governments and two countries. So I've accompanied the Prime Minister from day one, from our first visit since the election to the Solomon Islands, and myself visited another 9 nations in the 6 months that I've been responsible for coordinating the Step Up. Uniquely, the Prime Minister for the first time tasked me with responsibility across both the foreign affairs and the defence portfolios, the first time a minister has been sworn into both portfolios, working quite closely under Maurice Payne and Linda Reynolds respectively, to ensure the delivery of the Step Up in the Pacific is day-to-day and works, and minimise the roadblocks to its success. But the professional approach of DFAT, the defence staff, the ADF personnel, second to none, as they pursue our policy objectives and this significant priority of the Prime Minister and the government. There are 3 interlinked approaches that I think are important to the Step Up, which will determine its success. First, it is infrastructure and connectivity, both social and physical. And second, it's about the economics. And the third, I would say, is about the security and the resilience of the peoples and the places across the vast Pacific Ocean. And I want to say a little bit about each. Good quality infrastructure, of course, is the bedrock of any economy. Australia's got a great interest in ensuring that the Pacific has the right infrastructure and that every Pacific nation has access to this infrastructure, reliable, affordable, sustainable sources of financing to support the local infrastructure needs, regional needs, and enable opportunities for future development. The Southwest Pacific in particular, the challenge to deliver services in geographically isolated places and remote nations with small populations, smaller domestic markets, limited economic development, the opportunity of course is real. Economic integration with Australia and New Zealand is critical for the Pacific, and we know that hasn't always been successful. Australia and New Zealand combined represent about 98% of the GDP of the 18 Pacific Island foreign members. When you think about that, 98% of 18 countries' GDP between Australia and New Zealand, you understand how significant that is. Even PNG, the third largest economy in the Pacific, has a GDP which is only 10% that of New Zealand, but a population which is 70% larger than New Zealand. When you think about some of these facts, you start to understand the nature and the scale of the challenge that is faced by many of our Pacific partner countries. And for our part, I guess, we're investing the dividends of our own strong economic position to partner with countries in our region in addressing these challenges. This year, you will have seen the announcement of the $2 billion Australia Infrastructure Financing Facility for the Pacific, the AIFFP. It's been operational since 1 July. And in close consultation with Pacific governments and countries, it'll provide concessional grant and loan financing to support well-planned, high-quality, high-priority infrastructure, particularly focused on sectors like telecommunications, energy, transport and water. And we certainly asked the AIFFP to take into account climate-resilient infrastructure and climate adaptation infrastructure in response to Pacific needs. The government is also providing Export Finance Australia with additional credit and powers to finance overseas infrastructure projects in order to boost private investment in the region, and that's not typical. We don't usually ask the Export Finance Australia and give them additional credit and powers to make deals happen, but we are in relation to the Pacific. Through the delivery of this better quality and more reliable infrastructure, communities we think across the Pacific will be able to take advantage of improved conditions, attract investment and business opportunities. And what am I talking about? Well, for example, the Coral Sea cable that the federal government has funded between PNG Australia and Solomons and Australia to Moresby and Honiara enables faster, more reliable internet services in both of those countries. And this is a significant development opportunity for partners in those countries, significant opportunity for them to not just have reliable communications, which enables greater prosperity, but opportunities for business, NGOs, others to get in there and take advantage of the significant infrastructure from these cables that Australia has built. Analysis by the World Bank, of course, says that over the coming 20 years, that improved internet access and connectivity could create 300,000 new jobs and boost the region's GDP by $65 billion. And we agree with that. $5 billion, I should say, not 65. While digital infrastructure remains critical, and we think it'll help, so too does the provision of what I spoke about earlier, the climate and disaster-resilient infrastructure, the things that will last in terms of the disaster season, the resilient infrastructure in roads, schools, hospitals, seas, airports and seawalls. And earlier this year, the Prime Minister announced that a further $500 million would be committed to support climate and disaster resilience across the Pacific, building on the previous commitment of $300 million that had already been given. Some of this funding, of course, will go to specific projects that will help countries in the region understand and respond to climate change. But a significant proportion of our climate and disaster resilience funding will support existing infrastructure projects, like the Papua New Guinea Australia Transport Sector Program. It will build climate and disaster resilient roads, bridges, wharves, and work with local partners to ensure that climate resilient infrastructure lasts. And it only makes sense given the prevalence of disasters, the prevalence of catastrophic events on Pacific infrastructure, that we invest in these partnerships. And despite some contrary reporting at home, we have an unprecedented wave of clean energy investment in Australia. It's underway. It's leveraging our own investments in renewables that we've seen in Australia and renewable technology, and it sets us on track to meet and exceed our targets under the Paris Agreement. And of course, we'll help the Pacific move on from their dependence on expensive and obviously high carbon emitting diesel generation for power. And we're excited about those projects. In the Pacific, of course, we're making significant investments and other energy in renewable energy to support that low carbon growth. The sort of practical investment that we're talking about, I think, does leverage the technology that we have in Australia. It does leverage our businesses that are well established in this field. It will build the links with the Pacific in renewable energy generation that will make them more self-sufficient, not relying on either subsidies or other links to countries to power or generate power. And I think it will also obviously provide them with cheaper and cleaner electricity directly when they need it. And that technology and those business opportunities are real and will obviously see significant investment from the government's AIFFP. Other drivers, of course, that we see as vital in coming years, and we think will make a difference, include traditional sectors like tourism. Tourism, of course, you know, is an important driver in Pacific nations, and certainly we encourage Australians, when they are in places like Fiji, and we have a great Australian market in Fiji, to understand more about the country of Fiji, to get outside of the resorts, to see a little bit about how your average Fijian lives and understand and deal more with the local culture. 340,000 Australians visited Fiji in 2018. That's a significant economic opportunity in anyone's language and provides great opportunities for local businesses. And we also see traditional sectors like regional fisheries as another key economic sector that we want to advance. Probably from the Prime Minister down, the biggest initiative we'll see in that space is tackling illegal and unreported and unregulated fishing, which remains a significant problem for the region. When you consider that's a loss of about 150 million every single year for the region, that's a huge amount of money lost in illegal and unregulated fishing from different countries outside of the region. And one of the most practical ways we can lift that economic opportunity is to tackle illegal and unregulated fishing, and we're certainly doing so through initiatives like our Fusion Centre, data sharing, open source data sharing, working together with countries, agencies, and some of the programs I'll talk about shortly. Building on our environmental record in Australia and being a high standard economy and country in relation to the environment, tackling the potentially catastrophic impact of plastics in our ocean is another area of focus that the Prime Minister has led and Australia will assist in. Without action on ocean plastics, I think we know that scientists tell us that the weight of plastics in the ocean will equal that of the fish in the ocean within 30 years. And when you think about how that will impact the Pacific in particular, you understand why we are focused on practical environmental issues that need this action immediately. While climate change remains a great concern, of course, if there's more plastic in the ocean than fish, the fish are going to be long dead before climate change reaches them. We have to tackle ocean plastics, and we have to do it now. For Pacific states reliant on this fishing and income and sustenance, this is real, and we need to partner with them to address it. The Prime Minister has announced already that we will tackle plastics in the ocean. We'll work with our Pacific neighbours in order to reduce plastics and waste. We've already provided $16 million for the Pacific Ocean Litter Project. And of course, as the largest economy and security partner in the region, we have the capacity and the obligation to do more and use our own expertise to help. You've seen the Prime Minister lead initiatives in Australia to drive a change in our waste management sector. With other countries deciding that we'll no longer be exporting their waste for recycling or other things, the Prime Minister led COAG to actually put a hard and fast date on when we would no longer export waste from this country. And that will drive change in our waste management sector, drive waste in our behaviour, drive waste in our plastics and manufacturing sectors, and I think lead to better outcomes in the use of plastics. And in relation to our role as the economic and security partner in the region, we're also working to safeguard maritime exclusive economic zones in the world. Zones, of course, which are nearly 40 times the combined landmass of the nations concerned. And that's why the notion of the Blue Pacific is so important to our Pacific partners, because their sea boundaries, their maritime zones, are what is most important to their livelihood and their cultures. So we work to protect those fish stocks, and we work to protect them not just from illegal and unregulated fishing, but also from climate change, and our science and our climate science work in relation to fish stocks is exceptional. We certainly look at working to sustain coral reefs, biodiversity, fisheries management systems, capability, and securing maritime entitlements. Our fishing, of course, will continue to play a huge role within the region. Earlier this year, of course, we had a visit from the Marape government, the new Prime Minister James Marape, who visited us with a delegation, probably one of the most senior delegations we've seen in some time, governors, ministers, who visited us here in Australia and met with us around the cabinet table directly on Papua New Guinea and the aspirations of Papua New Guinea and that the new government has for it. To achieve the vision that Prime Minister Marape has said, he said that him and his generation of leaders need to recognise and transform, upskill and embrace diverse economic opportunities, tackle corruption and unlock resource potential that benefits all citizens. And Australia, of course, is a natural and willing partner for any Pacific nation that seeks to improve economic opportunities for its people. We absolutely support the government of PNG in its endeavours, and we have elevated the relationship between Papua New Guinea and Australia to a comprehensive economic strategic partnership, which we're working on with our officials now, to take it to the highest level that it's ever been and ensure that we use the renewed mandate of the Marape government to drive even more outcomes from our partnership. First established in 2006, of course, we also have the Australian Pacific Technical College, the renamed Training Coalition. This is key to one of Marape's key points about equipping Pacific Islanders and people from PNG with Australian standard skills and qualifications in technical and vocational careers. And of course, we're reshaping it to better align with industry needs, including sectors that have been overlooked, like agriculture and Australian agricultural expertise. Recently, we've seen other countries take this up. Ni Vanuatu APTC trained students use their skills and their training to create new amenities blocks, plumbing systems at schools in Vanuatu, and other countries where we've seen Australian training leading to greater outcomes. And from the government's perspective, building a capable and educated workforce in the Pacific with the right skills to help grow these local economies is absolutely the priority for us. And you'll continue to see more Pacific Islanders coming to Australia, joining in on our training, whether that be through the Defence Force training, whether it be through technical and vocational training, whether it be in our labour systems. We certainly want to see our training systems all geared to take on additional people from the Pacific and send them back with the skills they need. Certainly to deliver that economic change that we're seeking. And labour mobility across the Pacific and providing those workers is one of our key areas of success. It's combining on the work that we've done over a decade with different governments in Australia, but we've seen recently great take-up of the Pacific worker schemes that the government's introduced. The changes we've introduced provide even greater opportunity and flexibility for people in Australia to have Pacific workers and the Australian businesses that are supported by the scheme to thrive. And both Australia and New Zealand are good partners in this. We provide those economic opportunities for thousands of workers to come from the Pacific to our country and obviously learn skills, remit money and work. The World Bank describes this as a major transformational economic opportunity, and it is. And even more access to our market is something that we're going to continue to work on and group up in coming years. You know the schemes provide the opportunities that Pacific Islanders want, but of course the remittances that they send back home, they make a huge contribution to those countries, and including in remote regions. And when you think about how hard it is for government to make policy that benefits regions, I can give you an example from Vanuatu when I visited there. The biggest gain in economic average income in Vanuatu's history in the regions and the remote regions has come from access to the Australian Pacific Labour Scheme. And Vanuatu has the highest take-up rate. They reached a great critical mass of about 5,000 or more workers a year. And what that means is the remittances are going directly from people here to regions and remote areas, and you're seeing great economic change and uplift in regional areas where government policy struggles to reach or deliver economic change to those regions. That's exactly the kind of policy that we're looking at, exactly the kind of change that we want to achieve. Obviously, we've announced an expansion of the Pacific Labour Scheme right across the Pacific, and we're certainly seeing a lot of low and semi-skilled Pacific workers working in a range of industries in Australia, horticulture, meat processing, hospitality, aged care, where employers were otherwise unable to find suitable local workers. And we know the challenges in our own country finding suitable workers in regional parts of Australia. And I'll give you a couple of quick examples of good news stories. Ritati from Kiribati, she is the eldest of seven and aspires to run an events business. She studied hospitality at the APTC. She's now working on Hayman Island under the Pacific Labour Scheme, learning those skills. She sends money home for her siblings' education and has also used her savings to buy a car. She rents it out to others when she isn't using it. I'll give you another example. Samoan Ilia is a father of four. He studied at the APTC and also works on Hayman Island through the Pacific Labour Scheme. His earnings in Australia have supported the reopening of his family's corner store in remote Samoa, in a remote community, directly benefiting that community. The Pacific Labour Scheme, of course, is building on many of these successes of our seasonal worker program as well, and there are good news stories from that also. There were 12,000 workers supported under the seasonal worker program in 2018-19, and it's growing at about 40% a year. So you can see the demands are real, matching the demands in our own economy, and it's making a great contribution to the economies of the Pacific. We see Tongans in particular are major contributors to the seasonal worker programs and great contributors, and the remittances have comprised, and this is again very important to understand, 30 to 40% of Tonga's GDP have been remittances from Australia, you know, which of course is providing great economic uplift in the last 5 years. I think the mutually beneficial approach to jobs, skills and training is something that really connects our two countries and our two cultures and those people-to-people links. We know we've got these labour shortages in these sectors. We know they've got people willing to work who want the work and the skills. And we know that culturally the Pacific really does relate and fit in to our concept of Australian and Australian society. And we want to thank and commend all the Australian businesses who are playing a vital role in Pacific nations, but we also ask the businesses here and the businesses that are looking at this to do more and partner with us in our step up in the years ahead. We're certainly going to see more Pacific workers being used in Australia to make sure that we have greater connection with different Pacific partner countries and benefits both ways. I think Australian business can also lead the way in relation to this. We've got our initiatives, we've got our infrastructure financing facility, but it's really only business that can capitalise on the opportunities that flow from some of these great infrastructure projects and investments. And again, the government will be here to help. It's a top priority of our government. It will remain, in my view, a top priority of future federal governments, regardless of who's in government, for decades to come. I don't think you'll see a change in Australian foreign policy in relation to the Pacific for a long time now that Australia is back at full capacity, working and partnering, taking the Pacific as our first and most important relationship. I also want to say a word about Austrade in the Pacific. I think it does a great job in the Pacific, PNG and New Zealand in particular, partnering with them to support Australian business. They're always looking for the opportunities, but we're also working hard to support countries and provide investment certainty to business. Our role, of course, partnering with different countries is to do a better job of ensuring there is an investment climate that is attractive to finance and stable for businesses to invest. We know, of course, there's about 4,000 Australian businesses doing business in PNG at the moment. That's worth an estimated $2.5 billion. Australian investments in PNG in total are about $17 billion. And the businesses tell us that with patience and with the presence that they have, the Pacific can be a profitable place to invest. And we're certainly working with the government of PNG at the moment to ensure that their budget is well managed and they're doing a good job of really refinancing and managing their budget. And we're certainly speaking with them about a stable investment climate. It's certainly not just the big list of companies that are present too, and I want to point out this feature about them being engaged across the region, and I'll cite a Victorian company, Biofilter, as an example. It's working with our Australian aid program in Tuvalu and a local non-government organisation to provide new food growing technology to improve the availability and consumption of fresh produce. Thanks to the World Bank funding, we also see airports in Kiribati and Tonga being upgraded by Melbourne-based Reeves International. And Hunter H2O from Newcastle is working with the Water Authority of Fiji to better manage water distribution, water quality monitoring and improve emergency response times across Fiji. And certainly when I spent a week in Tuvalu as an atoll, a small place of 10,000 people, Australian businesses are being in there helping with food growing technology in a place where they have salinity issues, water issues, challenges in food production. It makes a huge difference when you consider Australia's the only country that even has a post there. Nobody else has a post there. Everybody came and visited, but we have a post. We work every day with them. We're helping build the local school. We're helping with food growing technology through our businesses. Really, Australia does a great job in so many different ways, and business is another arm of Australia and what we do. I think also dealing with water quality issues in the Pacific is a topic that I visited in Vanuatu in August is a key priority I recommend to business. Just last week, Austrade led a delegation of 40 to Honiara for a contractor's briefing by Solomon Water for a $75 million water and wastewater project, and another delegation of Fiji to the Water Authority of Fiji. Given our own challenges with water at the moment and drinking water, I think we can understand the challenges that are faced and use our technology and skill to help. These mutually beneficial projects are critical, and I think water will remain a key area for investment for our water utilities and water businesses to help in the Pacific step up. I want to turn for a moment to security and safety. I think this is an issue that is much talked about in relation to the Pacific, and I think we all know that the region is changing rapidly. We see the strategic, economic, technological and environmental changes that are taking place in the region, including the increased investment and competition for influence and the present opportunities and challenges that the Pacific face. I think how we harness these opportunities and defray the risks is a key component of the step up as well. Given the shared history, the heritage and the geography that we have, Australia, I think, remains today the security partner of choice for the Pacific region. and it's a responsibility we don't take lightly. We're committed to a secure and stable, and importantly, politically sovereign Pacific region. And sovereignty, we feel, is the essential key to the strength of Pacific countries. A consistent approach to managing our security and other investments in the region is absolutely important and a key focus of the step-up. It's undoubtedly in our self-interest to live in a stable region. We also know that others will look to challenge the status quo of our region, and this happens regularly in history. A consistent approach to managing our security and other investments in the region is very important in what we do. I think, as you know, we're the largest aid partner in the Pacific and remain so today by far. That's $1.4 billion every year from our aid and development budget into the region. That's the highest of any Australian government commitment and will continue to grow. Our contributions are more than the combined contributions of all other nations to Pacific countries. And I think it signifies our interest and commitment. In addition to our foreign aid investments, Australia's contribution to security in the region is significant, in particular through our defence and police engagement. And you might see much of the defence and police engagement, but I can tell you Australians don't know a lot of it as well. It's been constant commitment for 40 years, in some cases four decades, of cooperation, and it's consistent, regular and enhanced. Our particular flagship program, of course, is the Pacific Maritime Security Program. We've already delivered five of a new 21 Guardian-class patrol boats that have been gifted to Pacific nations by the government, and the remaining patrol boats constructed in Western Australia to be delivered by 2023. We think will provide that extra security, whether it be in relation to fisheries, whether it be in relation to policing, whether it be in relation to transnational crime. We know our Pacific partner countries are grateful to Australia for this excellent program. The boats, part of the $2 billion program, are essential in our view to economic and strategic security, and we're certainly working with our partners, including Timor-Leste, to deliver these boats. Our in-country advisor support also underpins our security strategy, and our upgrading of infrastructure assets such as wharves and other assets that relate to shipping, which is very important in the Pacific, will also enhance security and safety. We also provide an aerial surveillance capacity. It's managed through the Foreign Fisheries Agency. It provides the intelligence that maritime agencies need throughout the region, but it also allows coordination and regional cooperation in operational terms, which provides great benefits. This year, the recently completed Operation Solania supported the patrolling of the exclusive economic zones in Solomon Islands, Palau, the Federated States of Micronesia, to detect and deter illegal fishing, and it's a great success. We have this great ongoing support of regional police forces. We support their crime fighting, and we support the partnerships to stop new developments in transnational crime, even the scourge of drugs, which has hit the region in recent times. I want to praise in this sense our Australian Federal Police, the Home Affairs Department, and all of those that are working in the whole of government effort that we've created under the Office of the Pacific and the Pacific Step Up. The whole of government effort, in my view, has been one of the most successful operational elements of the Australian government in many decades. Now, I've served in a number of portfolios, as Jared says, the Treasury portfolio, which is a central agency, in the Immigration portfolio, which was a merged department of Immigration and Customs, and then I was there for the standing up of our new Home Affairs department. And in the time I've been in the executive, I haven't seen anything as effective or working as efficiently as the Office of the Pacific and the whole of government effort that underpins the Pacific Step Up. And that's good news, because sometimes in government, and you certainly, we can tell this joke anywhere in the world, we can make the joke anywhere, that the hardest thing, for government to do is to work with itself. We know that many departments find it very challenging to work with each other, more than they do with you, more than they do with business, more than they do with other governments sometimes. Certainly in the region, every politician knows what I'm talking about. But in Australia, we have managed to do a whole of government effort that collaborates between very significant and big departments, the two I administer, the Defence Department and the Foreign Affairs Department, cooperating efficiently, effectively, regularly, almost day by day. And when you add in complex agencies like Home Affairs, the Federal Police, Immigration, other components of our government, whether it be agriculture or other departments. We're certainly the envy of many places in the world. And when you look around the region, you see New Zealand has looked at what we're doing and done not a step up, but they call it a reset. Japan has refreshed their Pacific initiative after looking at what Australia's been doing. And the US, of course, speaks to us regularly and in our alliance about their view of the efficiency of how our government is able to cooperate with our government. And given how much bigger they are than us, I think there's inspiration from what we're doing and the drive that the government has in making sure this works and delivers outcomes for the Pacific. So tonight, of course, I've given you a small snapshot about all what we have been doing through our Pacific Step Up. It's probably mind-boggling for you to understand, but that isn't even the short version of what Australia is doing in the Pacific and what we have been doing for some time now. There is a lot more, and half an hour for once isn't enough. I like to speak less than the allotted time, generally, than in today's day and age. I find that's what people want. But in relation to the step up, even after six short months in the portfolio, I'm confident in looking everybody here in the eye and saying that Australia is doing everything we can to make our Pacific a stronger and more prosperous place and doing the right thing by the people of the Pacific. And I think that's where I'll finish today, is that that is what is key for Australia. The cultural and family ties that we share, making sure that we turn that into real prosperity, secure the sovereignty of the region against any threats or challenges as they come over the years, and unlock the potential that lies just in our backyard, our neighbourhood, the Pacific. We know it has significant infrastructure and investment needs, and we're going to be there the whole time to partner with other countries, to partner with multilateral donors, to partner with those that want to do the right thing by the people of the Pacific. And that means people who are there to help them. We'll partner with anyone. We'll partner with the US. We'll partner with China. As long as we're doing things together that enhance the health, the education, the infrastructure, the outcomes for Pacific countries and Pacific peoples. And we urge those partners to join us in that commitment to the region. Finally, I just say that Australia puts a high emphasis on our strong economy, and our government constantly talks to the Australian people about the strength of our economy. It's our greatest asset. It's our greatest enabler. It's our greatest security safeguard, a strong economy. A strong, free, vibrant economy protects us and secures us and enables our future prosperity. It's the same for the Pacific. We want to make sure they have strong economies. We want to make sure they have the ability to have independence and resilience through greater economic participation in our market and in the markets of others. Our relationship and our partnership with our Pacific family is honest, it's clear-eyed, it's pragmatic, and it accepts the difficult challenges and it looks for the opportunities that are there. I think 1 year on from the Prime Minister Scott Morrison's commitment to the Pacific Step Up, 6 months into my joining this role, I would say it's clear much has been achieved, but of course we know and we're open-eyed about the great challenges that are ahead. I want to thank you all for your patience tonight and just commend to you that you can be proud, and I think through the businesses and the community groups and the charities and the churches, the civil society, the military, the government, our foreign affairs arms, all of us are stepping up. And I'd encourage you all tonight to think about how we can step up together.
Well, many thanks to the Minister for a very comprehensive speech. And there are a lot of people here tonight. We've got to the top of the hour to for questions and discussion. So I ask you to keep your questions or your comments short, like this one. Minister, you spoke about our strategic involvement in the region. You specifically mentioned boats, you mentioned overflights. As you know, you're an officer in the reserve. What can you tell us about the relationship between the Australian Army and the various armies of the area?
Thanks, Jared. It's in very good shape. They're often the deepest relationships that we have as a country, because our defence cooperation program, for example, in PNG, is 40 years old.
It's been the most regularised contact and the most normalised contact, even in times when Australia might have shifted its focus slightly to other parts of the world. In different decades, the Defence Cooperation Programme remained strong and was enhanced throughout that period. I'll give you a good example. So we take cadets from all the different militaries in the Pacific, whether it's Fiji or whether it's PNG, and we train them at Duntroon in our military academy. And just this year I visited two cadets that stand out in different ways. One was the first female graduate into the PNG Defence Force. And of course, as you know, and Jared, I know you understand this, one of the biggest challenges in the region is, of course, our attitudes towards women and girls, domestic violence. It's one of the still the biggest issues that we face and the challenges we're working with our governments on. And it's a serious issue. So to meet her and to see her graduation as the first female officer into the PNG Defence Forces that had passed through Duntroon was a great success. The second cadet was from Fiji, and he was the first graduate of any Pacific country to come in the top five, which they rank every single year at Duntroon. So he had, on merit, graduated in the top five. He was fabulously popular, you know, with all of his peers here in Australia. And I think that underscores what we have been doing. Of course, I've asked CDF and the Defence Forces to ensure that we have even more people coming through Duntroon. We'll be training more Pacific cadets. We'll be having greater use of those relationships. And when you think, when I took Prime Minister Bainimarama to the Staff College there, and he addressed all of the officers at Staff College there, down there, just a few months ago when he visited to sign the Vivale Partnership. He was a graduate of that college, and they had a function afterwards with the cadets. Some of them came from his class, and, you know, he walked around the building. You know, he showed me exactly where they used to skite off as cadets, and, you know, the things. I learned a little bit about Frank and what they used to do, and, you know, as young officers, what you do and what you don't usually talk about. But the depth of the connection between his peer mates and the people that he'd made was as strong as you'd expect in any family or close relationship. And I think that underscores that Defence really has the best contacts. Still, of course, you'll find the relationships between the head of Defence Forces in all of those countries and our own is constant, regularised and strong. And certainly for the first time we convened the heads of Pacific Security in Australia in Brisbane. I addressed them. This is the first time in the region we've brought in the head of every police force, the head of every defence force, and had them around the same table talking about the challenges for security in the region. All reports was that was a stunning success. Not my speech, but, you know, not my address, but I think the actual day-to-day contact that they had with each other, that was the first time anyone had ever gathered them together as a region from a security perspective and a policing perspective to address the issues. And that will now be an annual event. So I think the relationships are strong, they're deep. We're also making sure they're enhanced as we move forward.
Minister, whilst we're on the subject of defence, obviously the ANZUS Treaty is preeminent with Australia's multilateral or bilateral commitments. Has there ever been any consideration given to a multilateral Pacific Australian Defence Treaty to complement the ANZUS Pact?
Look, thank you. That's an interesting question. Obviously, our alliance with the US is the cornerstone of Australian security. It remains the view of this government, and that treaty is obviously one of our most significant and most important. Regional security relies on a few things, and our view is, of course, to secure and enhance the individual sovereignty of each single nation within the Pacific. And so for us to sign a regional security treaty would require each of those sovereign nations to agree to that proposal. So you've suggested it. It's an interesting idea. Regional security may rely well one day on a regional security treaty, but we are not directly organising a multilateral regional treaty at this time. But of course, security, individual sovereignty allows the nations to talk about these things. It enables us to talk bilaterally, of course, as we do with each country, about their security. And certainly we work one-on-one security arrangements with Australia and countries. And it isn't unimaginable to think in the future that regional security will rely on some form of treaty or alliance. It's probably some time off. It's not something that has been talked about by Pacific leaders that I've spoken to, and listening to them, their security concerns day to day relate to how Australia and their country can partner together. But there's no doubt there's strong institutions in the Pacific, and the Pacific Islands Forum is one of them. There are others, and certainly our Pacific Heads of Security is probably a start down a path to ensure we discuss and cooperate on issues like regional security into the future.
Question up there.
Minister, there are 11 words in your speech which stood out for me.
Wow, which ones? Can I just let me look back over my notes? Yeah, right.
You've got to be brief.
Okay, so competition for influence, security partner of choice, challenge the status quo. One C word in the 3,000 words wasn't mentioned. China.
Yes. Yes. Actually mentioned.
How will China's foreign aid and soft power in the Pacific possibly force Australia to boost its foreign aid spending to keep the influence among the Pacific nations?
Yeah, well, look, I did actually mention China in my speech, and I can tell you what I said without looking at my notes. I said we do want to partner with China. I disagree with that. I think we do have some cooperation in the Pacific with China, and we have had it. If, for example, China wants to help us, and like we do in our programs, immunising hundreds and thousands of children in PNG. Literally, Australia immunises hundreds of thousands of children in Papua New Guinea against the most serious and difficult diseases. We'll certainly partner with them on that. If we can partner on good quality infrastructure, we will. With the geostrategic environment we're in, the media often reports the entire Pacific region through the competition lens, the US versus China. Just within 6 months in the role, Pacific leaders, while they understand the region very well, they understand the geostrategic narrative that's been built, they understand their relationship, where they are relative to China, to the US, to us, they don't see it all about competition. The great thing about Australia's role in the region is that we are the long-term partner. We're the trusted partner, we're the friend, we have the best relationship because we're genuine. Australians are good people. We deeply care. We're doing it not just for our own reasons, we're doing it because we believe in their mission to get better economic prosperity and improve quality of life in their countries. We're the most reliable partner. So I think we're the ones that are most turned to, and that's why we organise a lot of the partnerships ourselves. So what are we doing? Well, it's so hard to outline what we're doing because even just tonight is a small snapshot of it. But what we are doing is partnering with all of our allies. We partner greatly with the US to bring them into the region. We're bringing in Japan more and more to build that infrastructure and do good work. We're doing it with New Zealand, we're doing it with France, we're doing it with the UK. We're engaging countries, and we had many of them over at Tuvalu that I won't mention tonight, but they're from other parts of Europe or other parts of the world, because we think those partnerships, given the strategic time, people say the Pacific is more relevant, more important from all parts of the world than they have for a long time. And that is an opportunity as well as a difficulty. And so our message is the same to China. If you want to partner with us, we will partner with you. We'll help you build good quality infrastructure in partnership with us and other partners. And together we can do a lot. And it's the right message. And it sends the right message to the Pacific as well. And while we understand the strategic competitive issues, and we're certainly gripped up by those, we also speak regularly with our partners in the Pacific about issues that affect their sovereignty, including their levels of debt, making sure that no nation in the Pacific is indebted to anyone, whether it be a country, whether it be a state-owned enterprise, whether it be a lending institution of anyone's country, in a way that is unsustainable. And those conversations, I can tell you, are working. They are very gripped up by the fact that there have been some poor lending practices. There have been bad outcomes where countries have been put into debt, have received poor quality infrastructure, and therefore have an unsustainable level of debt to GDP ratios. So again, Australia's the good actor, we're the good partner. We have to use all arms of our government to make sure we're helping and partnering. And that means, of course, being responsible in how we approach the Pacific, being responsible in our narrative, not looking at it through just a geostrategic competitive lens. Because one thing about the Pacific and the people is they're shrewd people. They understand their own interests. They've seen actors from all around the world before. And if you're coming in to say, here we are, we're here to help, I back their ability to see through it. Now, sure, we may be able to sometimes help with technical advice and assistance, but we certainly can't fool anyone about what we're doing. And if we're not genuine as a country about what we're doing, I think the relationships will be damaged.
Minister, Louise Waterhouse, I'm the Honorary Consul for the Kingdom of Tonga and have been for nearly 25 years.
Thank
so
you.
I have to say, really, congratulations, because in that long time I've been looking after Tonga, I've never seen such wonderful enthusiasm and broad, across the board, support for Tonga. And I think it's interesting the support we've had with the Australian football players going over and playing for Tonga, turning their backs on $100,000, playing for $3,000.
You've got to be brief.
Okay, so that's one of the things about the connection we have between Tonga and Australia.
Okay.
But what I wanted to say to you is that I think there are a lot of opportunities where we can help Tonga stand on its own two feet, and one of those is agriculture.
Mm.
Only 30% of Tonga's
land
is cultivated, and we have the best soils, and we need Australia's help to make that all happen.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's it's an important point. So obviously Tonga, I had the opportunity to visit under sad circumstances with the passing of Prime Minister Pahiva. That was a real opener for me. He was one of the great statesmen of the Pacific, been there for a long time, but had the support of the people, and really I saw that in the whole funeral procession and the day, and the great outpouring of grief, you know, while I was there. So we sort of, really understand the nature of Tongan society and how it works together. So, and you know, I was able to take our first Pacifica MP, Member of Parliament in Australia, it's worth mentioning her, Elizabeth Cricket, from Canberra. She's a MLC in Canberra. She's of Tongan descent. Is from a Tongan family. She had family all around there when we went there, and I was able to take her as well, which is that is Australia's first person from the Pacific elected to a parliament in Australia, which is a great achievement as well. You're right. Agriculture is important. In brief, I would just say it's something we're now bringing on. We've certainly started that conversation with other countries. We think agriculture has been a bit underdone in relation to our expertise and using our expertise in discussions with countries. It's something we're going to continue to expand, but I think your point's well made.
Robin.
Nim Robin. Thank you very much, Minister. We hear in the media about the criticism by Pacific countries in relation to climate change. They blame Australia for not doing enough. Could you comment, please?
Yes, certainly. I'd always start any questions framed that way, saying, don't believe everything you read or hear in the media. But that's, a well-understood maxim in 2019. And being in Tuvalu for 1 week, full week, with the leaders representing Australia before Prime Minister Morrison arrived, it was important for me to meet all those leaders, the ones I hadn't already met or had a relationship with already, having been in Parliament a few years. And it was also important for me to listen very carefully to them about what they were really talking about and what was really important. And there's a great difference between what is reported about what happens in many of these forums and what actually is said and what actually goes on. And it isn't just a difference of factual reporting. It's a difference of, I think, the international media in particular puts an exceptional emphasis on the confrontation that we have over elements of climate change. And yes, Prime Minister Morrison stood up very firmly against calls to close every coal mine in Australia. And he did so in the Australian national interest. And he did so because those calls are not what the Paris Agreement calls for. Those calls are not what the international community has agreed to. So no Australian Prime Minister could go to Tuvalu and sit with anybody from anywhere and say, I'm going to agree to the closure of every coal mine in Australia without having
new baseload generation plans without having new technology plans to bring on new power. So those things are obvious, and yet the media sort of says, well, this has been a great epic clash of confrontation. It's not the full story. We are the single biggest nation that spends money on climate change in the Pacific every year. We're going to be spending even more next year, a record spend for the Australian government. And we're helping them to deal with the practical impacts of change. We don't argue esoterically about what is happening with climate change. When you're on a low-lying atoll like Tuvalu, where the highest elevation is 1 metre above sea level, that's the highest elevation, it's quite irrelevant what's causing sea level rises or waves coming over. We just want to help partner with them to make sure we can deal with it, that we can deliver things to help certainly help evacuate them to Fiji or other places where that might be needed, if that's the case. And in a certain sense, all Pacific Islands, given their small land masses, are always subject to the immediate impacts of any change in the world's climate. It has been the case historically and will be the case for years to come. So there's much agreement on climate, much agreement on action on climate change. We certainly stand up for our record on climate change as a country. We've had, I think, over now 1 billion tonnes of carbon abated. We've met our Kyoto targets. We're going to meet our Paris targets. We're leading in renewables investment in many sectors in the world. We're bringing that technology to Pacific Islands. These things are all agreed on in conversations that we have. And then, of course, we disagree. Sometimes if I was being cynical, I would say the most difficult people to deal with in Pacific Island nations are not Pacific Islanders. They're not peoples who've come from our Pacific family. And what do I mean by that? Well, perhaps the difficult negotiators are actually expat Australians. They're actually expat New Zealanders. They are the people that were the most difficult for Australia to negotiate with at Tuvalu. They're the people that actually had took the hardest line position against Australia. So we tend to find the process of getting together in the Pacific and having it out is a very Pacific thing to do, and the leaders did it. And Australia stood up for its position. And I was in the leaders' forum the next day where one of the Pacific Island leaders got up and said, I really respect Prime Minister Scott Morrison for the strength of his position, for the absolute respect for his standing up for his country, and for the agreement that was reached in the Kaneki 2 Declaration, which of course was an agreement of every single country. Those things are not reported by the media. Those things are never reported. And again, when everybody flies out of Tuvalu, which they did, every single country, every single person, every single climate change activist, the only people left behind is the Australian Post, the Australian Development Budget, the Australian Climate Change Spend, and us. They're the only people that are there now. So I think we're good actors. I think we can stand on our climate record here in Australia and overseas. And we're not sitting passively saying we've done enough. We're working with them to spend more and do more. So I think we're good actors, and I think we have a good partnership with them, and certainly the feedback we get from them.
Number one, final brief question and a brief reply.
Yes, quick question. Yeah. Thank you for that.
You've got to talk in the microphone.
Oh, sorry. Is that better? Thank you. Quick question, France, you mentioned. France is a traditional maritime power in the Pacific. Could you comment on the activities between Australia and France in the Pacific and the apparent upregulation, particularly in relation to the Navy and President Macron's visit not so long ago?
Yeah, thank you, Robin. Great question. We are partnering with France, and obviously France has still a vital and important role in the territories that it still administers and funds. And the security forces of France in the Pacific are some of the best. They are investing more in their navies in the Pacific, and our joint operations are being enhanced as well. We've had a joint operation recently with French naval forces. There are more planned. And President Macron and Prime Minister Morrison met, and where we increased some of our multilateral spends. President Macron not just visited recently, but is visiting again early next year. And they have agreed, and they are engaged on also increasing their commitment to the Pacific and their Pacific territories, and I think we're going to see more progress in that regard in the coming year. This is good because the more partners, the more investment, the more actors, the more delivery in the Pacific, I think is the best approach. And so France is engaged and interested, and I think you'll see from early next year will be an exciting year in the French-Australia-Pacific engagement.
Thank you, Minister.
Thank you, sir.
People here tonight say, well, I'll be brief. We could have gone all night, but we don't. We've finished on time and we're right on time. So, look, many thanks for a very comprehensive analysis tonight. There's a very important paper which we'll publish, and Sky News is here and our podcast is active, but I'm sure lots of people will be looking at it. I've followed Australian foreign policy for half a century and more, and I'm not aware of any such concentration on the Pacific as has occurred under the Morrison government with you as the key cabinet minister. So, congratulations on that, and well done tonight in telling us what you're doing in the first, nearly in the first year or so.
Yeah, thanks, Jack.
We'll have you back.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.